This is IT Visionaries, your number one source for actionable insights and exclusive interviews with CIOs, CTOs, and CISOs, and many more. I'm your host, Albert Chow, a former CIO, former sales VP, and now podcast host. Hey there, IT Visionaries listeners. It's time to supercharge your network with Zayo, the North American leader in modern network infrastructure. Zayo connects critical data centers across the United States, Canada, and Europe with high capacity, metro fiber, and extensive long-haul dark fiber. Trusted by the world's most innovative companies, Zayo embodies what's next in networking. Discover Zayo's expansive network maps on their website and see where their network can take you. With low latency, reliable 400G and 800G enabled routes, it's the modern network solution you've been searching for. Visit Zayo's website today to unlock the power of your network and tap into the technologies of tomorrow. Go to zayo.com/network now. Welcome back, everybody. IT Visionaries, we're excited to be back again with our new sponsor, Zayo Group. It is awesome to be back in the seat to hear and learn about technologies that are transforming the world. Today, we have a guest. He's the chief customer officer of a company called LibreStream. Now, let me read a little bit off of the LinkedIn page so you can kind of get a flavor, and then we'll have Charlie dive in and explain what this is. LibreStream is designed to increase operational efficiency with industrial AR, AI, and IoT. It solves a massive problem. You can kind of get a hint at what this problem is. I can tell you that if you go check out their Twitter handle, which is linked in the show notes below, you're going to see a lot of photos of people in, I would call, field work, but not just field work, but like dangerous field work. The people are in hard hats. They're definitely in remote areas, potentially. It looks like this is super important technology. Charlie, welcome to the show. We're excited to learn all about it. Let's start there. Tell us, for anyone who's, you know, trying to put the pieces together listening to this, what is LibreStream and what does it do?
Great. Thanks, Albert. Well, LibreStream is a knowledge delivery platform. And our platform is actually called OnSite. And it's really focused on getting the needed knowledge, data, information, know-how to a person who needs it at the moment they need it, wherever they are in the world and whatever device they're using. And, you know, as you said, we're focused in what we like to call the industrial worker. I liked your dangerous word. That makes us sound extra cool. but basically, people that operate outside the carpeted spaces of the world. You know, they're standing on concrete, they're standing on dirt, they're standing in or over water. And again, very focused on industrial companies. We have a really strong presence in energy and oil and gas, aerospace, heavy equipment, manufacturing, test and certification. We can talk about some of the common threads amongst our customers a little later on. But if you think about this idea of knowledge, knowledge delivery, that could be someone's expertise. That could be data that exists in a system of record at a company. It could be specifications, historical information, the perspective of somebody that's got more or different experience. The challenge that we see in the world is that at every moment of every day, somewhere, there is a process that is slowed down or stopped because someone is waiting for information or knowledge or something that they don't have. That if they only had that and they had it faster, that operation gets back up and running at full tilt or up and running from a full stop, which boils back down to dollars. I mean, the industries I listed, they're all, you know, expensive industries when it comes to downtime. So our focus is really on that knowledge delivery to surmount that slow down or stopped process challenge that comes up.
I agree 100% with you. I had my old roommate actually worked in a manufacturing plant. He worked for Ford Motor Company, and I got to hear some of the stories of how important it was and what things that were going on. You know, when we hear what you just said, because a lot of times when we've in like the past, if you've not been exposed to this industry or industrial work, you might think of this data where the service worker is at the time of need. You might think of it like looking up, you know, a SKU. Like, we're not talking about looking up a SKU. We're not talking about finding a pair of shoes in size 8 when you're not sure if they're on the shelf. We're talking about, and the reason why I say danger is because I know the great lengths that people that work in these industrial fields go to have safety. As you already stated, they're typically in places that if they're not doing the right thing, potentially things can go wrong. They are in charge of massive processes that are, like you just said, like worth unimaginable amount of values for these machines to keep running. Give us an idea of when you say you're going to bring this information to the worker, what does that mean? Because I can see someone who's maybe not as familiar with what you're talking about just saying, well, why can't they just get on a Zoom or a Teams call and just figure it out? Like, why do I need a platform to do this?
Right, right. So, you know, just a word on the safety side of things, you're absolutely right. One of the interesting dimensions to that, if you take something like an offshore oil and gas platform where we do a lot of work, to even get out to the platform, you have to be trained in all the safety protocols of the platform. You also have to do, basically, because you go by helicopter, you have to do this helicopter ditch training. So if you've ever seen videos of people doing this simulator where they put you in, basically a fuselage of a helicopter, strap you in, and then they invert it and dump it into a pool, like a swimming pool,
wow,
big swim, and you have to get out. And then first they do that with, I think they might give you oxygen the first time, and then you have to do it without oxygen. And then so basically the reason I'm saying all this is that because of all those really tough requirements, it's hard to get somebody out there, right? So the idea of,
okay,
of getting knowledge or something without having to physically bring a person makes a huge difference, because it's an astronomical cost to do that, as well as availability. Like, those helicopter seats are booked up months in advance. The time on the rig, the living space on the rig is all booked up. That's called, like, the most expensive hotel in the world is an offshore oil rig. To your question about why not use, Zoom or things like that, it's not just about a video collaboration, right? It's not just about what I like to call a carpeted spaced application, right? Your Zooms, your Microsoft Teams, those sort of things. It's really more about that information may come from a person. For example, you might be somebody who's saying, hey, Charlie, I can walk you through how to fix that thing. But a lot of times it's also data that needs to be acquired from a variety of systems. And oftentimes, if you talk to somebody in the field, they in their daily work have to interface with multiple systems. And it might be a field service software that tells them what their job is. Where this is the work order, this is where you're going, that sort of thing. They may have to go to a maintenance system to get the historical records on something, some other system to do some reporting or look up some specifications. It's a term we've actually coined called app hopping. So what's happened to a lot of these folks, and again, we're huge advocates of the field worker, is that their companies, through the best of intentions, have deployed all sorts of different systems. Hey, ERP here, CRM over here, FSM over here, all with great, intention and valid reasons. But then suddenly you can envision all these seven or eight systems funneling down and landing on one person who now has to interface with all these things. Our platform is really focused on shrinking that. The idea of making it almost a single pane of glass that allows you to contextually pull what I need for the thing I'm doing at the moment I'm doing from a different system here, a different system there, just to eliminate a lot of that app hopping challenge. And then, of course, if it's a, hey, I've got to call Albert because he's the one who can walk me through this, that capability is there. But sometimes we think of that as the defibrillator on the wall, right? You don't always need it. When you do need it, you really need it. But you don't want to be using a defibrillator every day. So most of our users are really in a scenario where they're accessing data, and our goal is to really streamline that, make them easier to find it and utilize it.
As you were telling that story, I was thinking about just actually this past weekend, I went to visit University of Wyoming. My father went there a long time ago. Anyways, on the drive from Wyoming from Laramie to Cheyenne, there was a huge field, huge. There was oil derricks. There were lots of wind turbines. And I was thinking to myself, as you were talking, how many people, service workers, have to go to those places? They have to fix or maintain or update whatever it is to be updated. And I was also thinking about how there was like no signal. and this was relatively close, I feel like. Don't get me wrong, Cheyenne and Laramie, they're not huge cities, but it was relatively close. About, if I was in the middle, it'd be like 22 miles, 23 miles to either or. And I was thinking to myself, You're talking about bringing seven applications to the worker, what used to be, or more, right? You're talking about using some levels of artificial intelligence, possibly augmented reality. How have you guys engineered this solution? Because it feels like an extremely data intensive application, but we already know a lot of these workers that work in these fields don't work at locations with, let's say, great Wi-Fi. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's not great Wi-Fi there.
Yeah, and no surprise, I think Wyoming probably has the lowest population density besides Alaska. So even if you're halfway between Cheyenne and Laramie, I could imagine it's a little bit challenged. One of the things, and this is maybe to touch back on the platform a little bit, it's sort of the other side of the coin. You mentioned wind turbines, and we do some work in that industry. And I know a guy who works for a company, used to work for Vestas, now he works for a service company. And he's an individual who can go up to a wind turbine. These are, I think the blades now are close to 200 feet.
And they're preposterously huge. When you actually get up next to one, it's unbelievable. You can't imagine how big this thing is. It's like, it's unfathomable how they even transport the parts because they're that big.
I've seen them going down the road. It's a significant wide load, but this guy can go up to the turbine, the base of the tower, and stand with his back to it, put his head against the tower and feel the vibration in the gearbox up in the nacelle and say, hey, that gearbox is a little rough. You know, now this is a guy who's been in the wind industry for 30 years, right? And he's colloquially known as the turbine whisperer, right? Now, there's only one of these guys. And therein lies the other challenge that exists in all of our companies. Everybody's got their version of the turbine whisperer, the guy who knows everything. And the challenge, and it's become significant, and it's going to get even more so in the next 6-7 years, is that any industry, anywhere in the world, the most knowledgeable and experienced people in those companies are leaving. Just, you know, we call it in the States, the baby boomer generation, right? But there's a demographic shift. You know, there's sort of the baby boomer equivalent globally of these people moving out of the workforce and taking with them the accumulated knowledge of 30, 40 years of experience. So the other focus that we do with our platform is not just knowledge delivery. It's also knowledge capture, because it's what I call the Paul McCartney problem. Okay, so Paul McCartney's 80 years old. If you want to see Paul McCartney live in concert, you got about 7 more years. Seems pretty healthy. Maybe he'll go to 90 plus. But anyway, at some point, he's not going to be performing live. So the same problem exists when you have these insanely knowledgeable people in your company who are going to retire in less than 7 years. When they leave, that's all gone. In fact, just to stay with the wind turbine example, we had a customer in the utility industry. They had a wind farm performing great, no issues. All of a sudden, boom, all the turbines start having problems. And they couldn't figure out why. And it took them a couple of months, but they eventually determined that there was a maintenance tech that served those turbines in that wind farm who retired. And he, kind of unbeknownst to anybody else, was doing a little extra stuff. Nothing like wrong. In fact, quite good. He was, I'm simplifying, he wasn't running around an oil can, but basically he was doing some sustained maintenance things, some extra actions that were very beneficial. When he left, nobody did that. Nobody knew about that. So his knowledge and his actions were gone and lost. And then, you know, back to this idea of downtime, the performance of the wind farm suffered until they figured it out. So one of the things that we're doing is focusing on this capture challenge, to take the knowledge that exists within people, embed it into a system that doesn't retire, so it's accessible to people, you know, going into the future. Because the other interesting thing is, our parents' generation wasn't uncommon to have a, you know, single employer throughout most of your career.
Yeah.
So you got 20, 30 year people in companies. You're not going to hire a 24-year-old and expect them to be here in 5 years. It's just, so now this knowledge loss becomes perpetual, right? You've got a turnover of people. So the challenge is, how do you get them up to speed quickly? And how do you preserve knowledge in your company in a way that, and when those people leave in 3 to 5 years, you don't suffer a loss there as well.
Yeah. And the way you were describing it. So actually one of my first gigs out of school, I wanted to be a MotoGP tech, which was a motorcycle mechanics. It's MotoGP is like the Formula One of motorcycle racing. So the highest level of racing there is in motorcycle racing. And I remember working at my mechanic school with what you just described as someone who could literally hear the bike and know the problem. I was like, what are you talking about? And he says, I can hear it. The chain's loose. Or I can hear it. There's a cam that's off. Or I can hear it. There's a valve loose. Like, it sounds the same. Sounds the same to me. Yeah. And these trade skills, you know, that's the thing about a lot of industrial work is for a lot of white collar workers, or however you want to name them, knowledge workers. Sure. You're working, you have a lot of knowledge and it's strongly applicable, but there's something about the field where you're actually dealing with physical objects where it's not really easy to Google what's wrong. it's just super hard. You like either know it or you don't. And if you don't, it typically requires an investigation of some sort, some type of assessment, some type of tear down, some type of long process. So if you're talking about those oil and gas derricks, assembly lines, manufacturing facilities, we already know they can't afford to do that. They can't afford to stop ops and be like, oh, let's figure it out. They want, they want the knowledge to be known super quick. Give us an idea of what you and your company's vision for the future of how this is going to be solved. Because inside of the company, the taglines for you guys, you're talking about also adding elements of industrial AR, AI, and IoT. That makes me feel like I'm going to bring, I'm just going to put words in your mouth, but you'll clarify. That makes me feel like I'm going to bring devices to the problem and it's going to somehow, I don't know, create a virtualized version so that I can quickly see what's wrong and help me solve it quicker. Maybe even guide me and pinpoint me to the problem faster. That'd be kind of cool. That's what I'm thinking.
So, boy, there's a whole bunch of things in that. So I'm gonna range around. Slow me down if I'm going off the rails.
No,
I think it's probably good to define the term. I'll start with augmented reality because everybody's got a different idea of what that is. And usually, if you say to somebody at a cocktail party, augmented reality, they're immediately going to go to this idea of a visual representation, cartoon, if you will, that is superimposed over what I'm looking at. Here's how the screwdriver unscrews the panel and the panel comes out, all that sort of thing. And I think it's important to remember that we as humans are not just visual creatures. So we have many, many senses and our reality is not just what we see. So when Lieberstream talks about augmented reality, we talk about augmenting the reality of our user, meaning, yes, we provide them with visual capabilities and things perhaps overlaying or being spatially fixed and persistent in the real world. But we also talk about augmenting their knowledge. If you know something, if you can get information that you didn't have otherwise, you've been augmented in that way. We talk about, in some cases, augmenting their other senses, right? The ability to pull in IoT data. So I might be looking at a compressor in a facility and it's just humming away. No instrumentation on it, no gauge, no nothing. Well, that might be instrumented in an IoT scenario. So we can see input pressure, output pressure, rotational speed, temperature, all anything that's instrumented. We can put that up on that user's device. So now as they're looking at this piece of equipment and adjusting it, they can see real time what those effects are, even though there's no instrumentation physically in the world in front of them. So our definition
that's pretty
of,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, our definition of AR is really broader than the cartoon floating in space. So I always like to lay that out there. When it comes to you mentioned, the field worker, the tech worker, there's a lot of things that we can do to help their job easier. I don't believe we'll ever replace a human when it comes to doing that kind of work. Humans do things extremely. We've got millions of years of evolution to create, very dexterous fingers and problem solving skills and all sorts of things like that. What we want to do is reduce the cognitive load. And what I mean by that is offload the things that people maybe don't do as well. Maybe historically, we're not great observers. We don't have particularly good memories. We don't necessarily correlate vast amounts of data very effectively as individuals. So if we offload that to a system, then the human can focus on doing the things that humans do very well, solving problems, physically dexterous stuff. I mean, it's a little bit like, think about the last time you went anywhere that you had never been before by car. Maybe when you were in Wyoming. You punch in the address in your phone, and it says, here you go. This is the direction. You didn't get out an atlas or a map and write down on a sheet of paper, turn left and Route 142. You just offloaded that cognitive load of the directions to a system, and you focused on what you do best. Drive down the road, stay 10 miles above the speed limit, don't hit the tumbleweed or dog or whatever. So that's the scenario, right? We do it all the time in our personal lives. It's how do we do that for these industrial workers?
I'm starting to get a really cool picture of what you guys are doing with different companies in different fields, different sectors, industrial sectors. Give me an idea of when this starts getting implemented, because every company is going to have different processes or knowledge, their knowledge base that they need to deliver as well as capture, transfer. It's going to be somewhat unique. There's going to be certain things I'm sure going to overlap, certain like pieces of equipment, for example, are probably used in many, many fields, or at least this in many times in the similar fields. So how does it begin? Like you have the platform that can grab the information, deliver it. You could also have to capture it and bring it back. How does an implementation begin, though? Because every company is going to have different policies, processes, safety procedures. It's going to have all kinds of stuff that they're going to want to, I would assume, deliver and capture. It feels like it takes a long time. Give us an idea. What does it look like if I need your services? What's it look like to implement this?
So there's a couple things. One, we're not replacing systems that exist or systems of record, right, or sources of knowledge. Because as you said, they are going to be unique to each company. And the working premise is that the answer is within one's own company, right? So somebody or something or somewhere there's that answer, that knowledge, or that bit of data that the user might need. What we typically see and our customers find is they've historically started with some of the collaboration capabilities, right? So the remote expert capabilities, the video collaboration stuff. Some digital work instructions or work processes to guide people through that. So you start with that. From there, to some extent, we look to our customers to where their pinch point is, because again, this idea of knowledge loss and people loss and things like that is universal. So one of the most important questions we ask of any customer is, do you have this problem? And I can tell you, Albert, that everybody says, absolutely, we have it, right?
Yeah, we have this problem.
yeah. And so the next question is, how is it manifesting itself, right? Oh, well, we can't get enough people to do X job, or we can't get enough inspectors to cover all the survey work we have to do in a given day. Okay, what are you guys doing about it? Well, we've tried to route people and do some intelligent routing, and that didn't work. And so basically what we try and focus on is, where's the place that we can be most impactful? Because don't get me wrong, like I'm a huge technology guy, but LibreStream has a bit of a reputation of saying cool technology is awesome. Like amazing demos, futuristic stuff, sounds great, awesome. What we always want to be doing is having an impact right now. So where do you start right now to make a meaningful impact and then broaden from there? So, the idea of go narrow and deep in a particular area and then widen from there, but be impactful in a way that may even not be the sexy technology part, but how can you do it in a way that impacts the company right away?
Visit Zayo's website today to unlock the power of your network and tap into the technologies of tomorrow. Go to zayo.com/network now. Give us an idea of what, I guess, it takes to do this, because I'm assuming there has to be certain requirements on the customer side. It sounds like when I hear you talk about this, and again, what's almost impossible to figure out is what each listener is hearing, right? Because they're all painting a picture in their mind, kind of what you just said before. But you're talking about service work, industrial work, remote places, places where network's going to be possibly not even there, that they might only have be limited to handheld, right? You're talking about comms tools. You're talking about bringing knowledge to the person. You're talking about capturing knowledge and bringing it back. Give us an idea. Do you tell the customers they need specific technical requirements to make this happen? Or have your engineers figured out a way to stick this into all different types of environments, because I know, for example, I mean, I worked for a company that worked out of Canada. I saw you guys are HQ in Canada. It was in Alberta. I was on site once for it, and they did the oil sands mining.
Yep. Fort Mac.
Exactly. In Fort McMurray, I believe it was, in Alberta.
Yep.
And I asked them, like, well, what kind of, you know, how will this training, it was online training, get there? And like, oh, we're going to download and bring it to them on disk. And I was like, this is, and I was like, what? It's like, yeah, there's no cloud there, bro. I mean, of course, this is like 2007, but I do know that a lot of these places are going to have limitations. They're not like your normal office location in the middle of a city. When you sit down and work, because I'm sure you hear all different types of setups, how have you guys approached this problem? Because it's a problem in the field you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, probably is a touchstone into our origin story. So LibreStream is going to be 20 years old in September of this year. So when the company started, the founders really were, actually the founders were hardware guys. Originally, they had a background in industrial barcode scanning and technologies associated with that. And long story short, they, through their company was acquired, they ended up having to go to Taiwan quite a bit to, as engineers, to help with productization, getting on the production floor, things like that. And they were going from Winnipeg to Taiwan quite a bit. And they'd often get there and be like 20 minutes on the floor and they'd solve the problem. And then like, okay, get on a plane back to Winnipeg. So they said, there's got to be a better way to do this.
I'm just imagining flying from Winnipeg to Taiwan for a 20-minute solution session. That seems a bit much, but okay.
So they really came up with the idea and, in fact, invented the whole concept of remote expert. And now don't forget, this is 2006 or 2003 when they first started. But, you know, 2005, 2006, when the commercial deployment happened, they had built their own camera, which looked like a really beefy SLR. It was all ruggedized. And the only other device that it would stream to was a PC, pre-smartphone, pre-broadband. So, you know, it's your oil sands example writ large. And we had two companies that were the first customers. One was Boeing. The other one was Baker Hughes. Baker Hughes is a oil services company like a Schlumberger or a Halliburton. And, you know, each one of those kind of brought some specific requirements. Boeing came and said, hey, we love this. It's going to be great for our manufacturers. It's going to be great for our on-wing care. But we need a laundry list of security requirements. And so what got baked in from the beginning was all these requirements. And we have a tremendous amount, about 85% of the largest aerospace and defense customers in the world use our platform. And, you know, we do stuff with the DoD, et cetera, et cetera. And we've got a litany of security. A lot of that stuff from like the original Boeing stuff is tougher than anything we've seen since. But that's been a hallmark of the platform. The other part from the other first customer there, Baker Hughes, they were in the North Sea, offshore rigs, 56K dial-up from the rig. And they were like, you can't use all of it. Like, you can get 20 kilobytes.
You can't all my 56 kilobytes, can't use all of it. Like, wait, you want me to do what?
Yeah. So they basically said, but we need to be able, you know, we said, oh, well, we figured out a way. We built a streaming protocol to be able to do that. I shouldn't say I wasn't with the company at the time, but that allowed you to transmit video, degraded quality, but still video in that constrained environment. And they said, oh, this is great. We love it. But we are trying to inspect the condition of a weld that's exposed to the salt air in the North Sea to determine, does this railing need to be replaced or not, whatever. So we need to be able to see that detail. So they said, hey, can we capture, you know, how do we see that level of detail? So the other guys thought about it. And they said, well, what if we just gave you a still image? Like, well, that would work. So, you know, they came up with this idea of saying, well, we'll capture a you know, in the degraded environment, we'll still capture a high-res image and transmit that. You know, to think about your oil sands example, and this is, you know, less and less a factor these days because we've got a lot more broadband. We've got, you know, Starlink and other things in the world that you pretty high bandwidth everywhere are getting there. If you can do 1080p, you can do 1080p all day long. Fantastic. But if you don't, we adapt that bit stream down so it's a lower bit rate to live within that. When it gets really bad, we cut the video and keep the audio because might sound strange, but audio is more valuable than video because you can convey more information in audio, right? I mean, we're doing a podcast and there's a video element to this, but most people listen to the podcast while they're driving. They're getting it all through audio. Like, we listen to the radio, but we don't watch TV with the sound turned down. So audio is actually a more data-rich payload than video. So but the point is, to your original question, how do you deal with that? We basically have created these different means of conveying data and information in really constrained environments. Once we built that road to live in those kind of environments, which we would traditionally call network rugged, physically rugged, like you said earlier, dangerous, but also network rugged. Now you've got that road. What else can you drive on it? Well, we can drive digital work instructions. We can do more asymmetric stuff like optical character recognition, computer vision, natural language translations, things like that. So, but it's definitely been our hallmark of, we start with that worker that's in, you know, the challenging environment from both a physical and network perspective.
I'm going to have to use that soundbite for Mission Commercial, that the audio audio data is actually more enriched and we learn better from audio than audio and video. I mean, I was like, yeah, I hear it. you mentioned just briefly, it was super brief, but because I was starting to think, whenever I talk with our guests, I was thinking about, well, what's the future going to unlock? What are certain things that are going to happen? What's stopping from the future from being the present? And I know you're in, you know, there's certain things for your customer base that's out of your control. There's security requirements, as you already mentioned. Some of these things are highly secured, understanding the oil, gas. I mean, for anyone listening, let's just use oil and gas. Just knowing the delivery schedules have to be secured. Okay. They have to be secured because if they get compromised, it's a potential threat to a lot of different things. So security is a big requirement. Infrastructure, just the straight physical locations of these places. You mentioned before that technology is expanding to make it so it's more accessible to these remote places, and that's going to continue. But I'm thinking to myself, like, when is that, what you just mentioned, going to unlock? You mentioned like natural language processing, possibly across languages. Like, could we get to a point where, let's use that example of like this knowledge expert in the world of wind turbines is the absolute genius of wind turbines. All the person needs to do is see it and hear it. They can figure out what's wrong with it. Could that ever become a source of help for anybody anywhere in the world speaking any language? That'd be crazy, but technology has to catch up, it sounds like, to let that happen. What do you see unlocking, I guess, if, you know, security protocol gets everyone's on the same security protocols, network keeps expanding. What do you see the future looking like for this industry?
Yeah, I mean, on the natural language processing side, I mean, we do that today. So if you only spoke German, that's awesome. I only spoke Swedish, we could actually do a conversation, and we could either have that transcribed via text or actually spoken out. So, you know, we're taking advantage of a lot of the AI work that's being done by a lot of the big AI players to utilize that. I'm going to sound like a broken record in this, but I'm a huge end user advocate. Even within LibreStream, I'm probably the biggest banger of that drum. And so often we take for granted the technology that we have in our offices or in our back to our carpet phase example. And bringing that to the people in the field is really what we're focused on doing. So a lot of the things that we, you know, this is going to sound crazy, but a lot of the folks in the field, I've just gotten smartphones like in the last few years. So the idea of making that technology available to them, again, to reduce their cognitive load, to reduce the friction in their job.
Yeah, the cognitive load piece is something to think about when it comes to, like, because you mentioned there's going to be a wave of people retiring in the next handful of years. And there's, for whatever reasons, there's just not as many people interested in that kind of work nowadays. We know that recruiting in many of the labor fields is really challenging. I mean, you think it's tough in the tech sector. I heard labor sector, like we've had fleet managers, CDLs, the ports, the people that operate the cranes. Talk about how, like, no, there's not enough people want to do this. I read an article recently about pilots, like how there's like a massive pilot shortage now. Not enough people know how to fly. And this gap is going to need to get closed of like, meaning of no experience and willing to experience and I guess safe. Safety is key, right? It capable.
Yeah.
And we're talking about closing that gap. How do you see the future of learning these trades? Do you see a place where, you know, technology gets to the point where everything's going to be done virtually? Like you're going to be sitting at home. Like I can learn how to fly like here in my house. Like I'd love to hear your perspective on the future, regardless of LibreStream. Like how are these like, I call them physical skills because you can't, you know, flying is, there's machines, there's levers, there's, you know, there's, and of course you can't make mistake. you gotta be perfect. Do you see a place where we're going to start learning this stuff at home and you can just, I don't know, train to be a pilot from my desk? It doesn't feel like I could, but I don't know.
Yeah, probably not, though. I have to say, I know some guys who, so we do some work with Gulfstream, and if you, it will, when you buy your you know, next Gulfstream, Albert, when you go to get certified to fly that aircraft, you can do your full certification on their simulators in Savannah. And the first time you ever do, when you take possession of your plane, assuming you're flying it, that will be the first time you'll ever actually physically have flown it. But now again, this isn't, you know, Microsoft Flight Simulator running on your PC at home, right? These are pretty significant flight simulators. If you've ever seen one in the flesh, it's you would never know you weren't in an aircraft. So, but to your question on are we going to virtually train? I don't think it's going to be that extreme. I think what we will see is additional capabilities and platforms that allow somebody to perform at a level beyond their experience and expertise. Meaning, we're not going to take somebody who has never done this and say, okay, time to do heart surgery. You know, it's going to be, how do you take a level one tech and enable them to do a level two tech or a level three tech's job? Or how do you shorten that time? Whereas historically, it might have taken 5 years to get from level one to level three. Again, maintaining safety protocols and all the other stuff. How do you accelerate that learning process? And we're going to need to.
Yeah. Someone once mentioned to me that he took it from the Malcolm Gladwell Outliers concept of 10,000 hours. And he was just saying that, you know, that's, if there was a way to create more, he called them at bats, but like if there was a way to create more at bats, right? So for example, if you've been fixing wind turbines for 30 years, the amount of turbines you fixed is astronomically significantly more than someone who, of course, maybe is first in the field or training for the first time, because they have to encounter the problem in order to be able to recognize the problem, fix the problem. And so the idea, like, is there a future where technologies like yours are going to give me, the trainee, more at bats than I would otherwise encounter in the field? I think that's highly plausible. And so I think that's pretty exciting to think about what's potentially coming down the road with companies like yours doing what, because these, this, one of the major goals of why we went on break at IT Visionaries and took a pause is like, we wanted to talk to more people that were in technology that was going to shape, I don't want to belittle other software companies, but like more of the physical critical things that we need. And because I feel like a lot of technologists kind of forget that, like most of the things we actually need are physical things. Like they're not chat apps. Like we don't need another chat app, you know, but if you're using chat to help me fix a wind turbine so I have electricity in my house, I think that's good. That's pretty dang good. You know, so for yourself, when people, I guess, sit down with you and they're learning what LibreStream can do and they're asking you questions of like how this can impact learning, what are some stories you tell to demonstrate, like, hey, this is, it takes people, you know, they were doing A to B and it took this long before and now this is what we look like today.
Right, right. Talk about your at-bat example or your comment about there just not being enough people to do the job. So there's a couple ways to do it.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's not going to be, unless somebody, you know, invents a clone army or some really good robots or something like that, but I don't think that's going to happen. The other way to approach this, though, is how do you take the people you have and make them more effective? So I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. One of our big industries that we work in is something called the test inspection and certification industry. TIC is what it's known. Hmm. And these are companies that you've probably heard of, some of them like Lloyd's Register, Bureau Veritas, SGS, and most of them are actually based in Europe, but they are in the certification business and testing and certify things. Kind of like the UL certification, the CE certification. If you ever look at the bottom of a lamp, that sticker that's on there. But anyway, these guys in all sorts of industries, and in fact, in a lot of the other industries we work in, we see them also playing a role. But they're doing verifications and inspections all over the world on anything from manufacturing to border crossing to the integrity of a hull, a ship. And today, these companies are doing, using our platform, about 4,200 inspections per week using our platform. And so, you know, the quick kind of obvious thing is, wow, that's awesome. If you're doing an inspection virtually instead of going to do the inspection, well, you're saving all that travel cost, et cetera, et cetera. But that's actually dwarfed by the bigger result, which is the effectiveness of an individual inspector. Now, previously, somebody might be able to do 3, maybe 4 inspections a day. But now if they're doing them virtually, they're doing 10 a day. So now you've just taken your existing capacity, if you will, of your most scarce resource, which is a human, a skilled and knowledgeable human, and you've 2x'd it, or 2+x'd it. So that's another way that we are going to solve this problem. It's not so much how do we train people faster, though that has a play. It's how do we scale people's time? I'll give you another example, right? So field service tech, do an elevator repair. Going out, servicing an elevator, whatever the problem, door closing too hard, something like that. They do their work. Okay, they now have to do, took them 30 minutes to do the job. I'm making these numbers up, but let's say it takes them 30 minutes to do the job. They now have to do some post-job reporting. Hey, this is what I did. Hey, this is parts I ordered. This is when the job is complete. Got the signature. If you ask that tech, and we talked a lot of end users, field techs are awesome. They are the superheroes of the industry because they go out and they solve the problem. And they're people that are wired for doing that, which is great. They don't see the back-end post-work paperwork as solving the problem, right? Superman doesn't write up an after-action report and turn it into the Justice League, you know? So how do we offload that stuff, automate that stuff, use AI to make that faster? So now your person, instead of doing 30 minutes of work, 30 minutes of reporting or 20 minutes of reporting, and now you take that 20 minutes out, they're now, their capacity's gone up, probably their job satisfaction's gone up too. And so that's really where we're looking for those ways. Again, this is the, I dare say, non-sexy stuff that actually has a huge impact on how to make our workforce more effective.
Charlie, I'll tell you what, that's an amazing example. For those listening, you might ask, like, oh, did you plant this and time this out? No, it did not. My son was actually stuck in an elevator this past week. And he was. And the fire department came, and there was an inspector there was a engineer or someone from the elevator service company that did their thing and had to do their post checks and all that other stuff. And sure enough, when, you know, the kids are taking pictures next to the fire truck because they're all been released, the hockey team is now freed. They're doing TikToks and dancing. This poor guy, he's doing something with a notepad. And what was weird was a notepad. He was still using carbon paper. So I'm guessing it's a little bit of reporting on that. He didn't even have, you know, those digital pads that there's typing in what happened. He was like writing up what happened and taking pictures of it.
There's some low hanging fruit out there. Definitely. Wow. Well, that building that you mentioned in Raleigh that you know well, if you go into elevator number C, you go past floor 6 or 7, it always goes clunk, makes a couple really loud clunky noises. Still not sure about that. So someday I might be on the news being trapped in the elevator too, because we always wonder about that.
Does that elevator system still have the one where you have to type in the floor you go to and then it like delivers you the car?
Yes.
So annoying. Yeah. I can't stand that thing. It's supposed to optimize transport, but I know every morning I see a giant crowd of people not getting the elevator.
And there's one that never shows up. I've never been in the A elevator, so that must be the for the elite or something, because it never tells
me. Maybe it's a service elevator. Who knows? Maybe. I had to think back to my time there if I ever got to ride an A. I don't remember. Well, Charlie, it was awesome having you on the show. You know, one of the things, like I said, this whole season about IT Visionaries, we want to meet the people that are building the solutions that are going to help shape the physical future. This sounds exactly like what we're talking about. The reality is 100% of the people on Earth currently today rely on industrial machines and services to work. And it is a serious task to keep any of these things running and operating. Most of them run and operate, like, you know this better than anybody, 24/7. These companies don't stop. The people that do these jobs do not stop. So anything that makes it easier, since Charlie already hit the nail on the head, there's not more people running into these fields. There's not. We want them to be, but there's not. Not enough people want to do these jobs. So if he's making it easier, giving people capacity, making it easier to train, taking away some of the more mundane things that, like we just talked about, those reports, this is going to help society in a big way. Charlie, I want to say thank you for joining us today on IT Visionaries and sharing what LibreStream is doing for the industrial worker.
Thanks for having me, Albert. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Wait. Is that jitter? No, just playing. It is time to check yourself with a little network health checkup brought to us by Zayo. This is where we ask questions about network health for modern infrastructure. Charlie, your software depends on things going right. And I know you're not in charge of the network all the time. So we're going to ask you a couple questions. Says you kind of, we could pretend like if you could recommend someone to do this in the future, what would they do? You ready?
Fire away.
All right. Let's start here. What are some of the emerging technologies you're most excited about that can potentially make it easier for you guys to transfer data? Because you mentioned earlier that LibreStream has figured out ways to basically lower the bitrate and move data across low latency networks. That's seemingly simple solution, but I know it's technically hard. Give us an idea. What are some of the other things that you're hopefully looking forward to that maybe you don't have to do that for it? Maybe you don't have to, you won't be required to do that anymore.
Sure. It's, one thing is just the broader deployment of network infrastructure. I mentioned earlier the North Sea where we got our start. You know, today there's companies that have done a fantastic job of wiring that out and putting together so you can get great connectivity there. I think there's a rising tide all over. That said, there are still places in West Texas or Wyoming that connectivity is a challenge, or even in we're riding on Wi-Fi or cellular or even satellite, but you could be in the middle of Manhattan and be in a data center three stories down, you're not going to get anything, or in a paper mill where everything's a gigantic 3 football field long steel machine making paper that's creating a Faraday effect, so you're not getting connectivity. So the reality is that I'm bullish on the fact that demand will instigate supply in those scenarios, because as the world gets more and more connected, whether that's IoT devices and assets, physical assets, or human elements, we're going to deploy where it's needed. So I'm bullish on the continuing rising tide of available connectivity.
Yeah, no doubt. I can see. I agree. I think the device makers are going to figure out ways to bring that high speed internet everywhere. I always talk to other team members about how the internet's nothing but a bunch of lines in the dirt, and unfortunately, you can't run a line everywhere. So someone's got to figure out a way to bring it somewhere else without a line. And I think you're going to see more and more technology companies invest in that type of future. For yourself, one of the things that is critical in your field, or many fields now, but specifically yours, is all things have to be always connected. For yourself, when you think of other companies, how do you think they should best approach this idea to remove single points of failure? Because obviously, if you only have one source of connectivity, that's a serious problem. How do you think companies should approach removing those single points of failure?
So certainly, there's a couple approaches. You know, our approach usually is, again, from our background, is how do you operate in an offline mode? So one of the ways that we look at this is, what can we cache at the edge? What can we actually cache on the device? So, as we start to put more and more AI into our platform, as there are elements of that we can localize in some way where you don't necessarily need to have full back-end connectivity.
Okay, you're the first person that's ever said this, which I thought was pretty cool. So if you're listening casually and you were just washing your dishes or something, pick that back up, rewind it a second. Charlie says, you should almost engineer your solutions as if there won't be connectivity. He's talking about caching things at the edge. I mean, that's as smart as it gets right there. Like, why not? Yeah, that's it. That's it. Well, Charlie, it was awesome having you on the show. For your audience out there, Did you hear or did you answer the same way as Charlie did? Because if not, you might want to check out the Network Health Check presented by Zayo. It's a free questionnaire that can guide you towards better network health for modern application use cases. Customers today are unforgiving when they can't access their applications. Don't let your network be the cause. Check it out. Network Health Check.